countdown shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Well, hello all. Here we are again. Would you believe that it is the 20th of August in the glorious future year of 2022? Would you also believe that this may be the last live show for a while? And I'll tell you why. It's nothing sinister. It's just that Tuesday I'm very likely to be extremely busy putting stuff into a moving truck. I'm not moving. I'm taking some things to my sibling. So Wednesday I leave and I drive to the northern tier, passing by Tobe in the distance and waving to Tobe on my left. And then from there, I will drive to Chicago for the World Science Fiction Convention. And so Tuesday is a packing the truck day. Friday is an unpacking the truck day. Saturday is a driving to Chicago day. The following Tuesday, okay, where was I? Okay, I've confused myself now. Okay, the following Tuesday, I may or may not, depending on things like the internet connection in my hotel room, may or may not do a live show. Friday, I'm definitely going to be busy with the Worldcon. If the only way I'm going to do a live show is if I'm doing it live from my booth at the convention. And that depends on how stable the internet connection there is. I wouldn't count on it if I were you. And then Saturday, I might be able to do a show live from the booth at the convention. We will see. Again, it depends on the internet connection stability. Or if I have a phone which I can just call in via the dial-in. That's the other option. Then Tuesday, yes. Tuesday, September 6th, I may do a show from my hotel room in Chicago, but I may not. Hard to tell. I'm not making any commitments at this point because I don't know how things will shake out. It would be stupid for me to promise you something that I'm not able to deliver, so I try to avoid doing stupid things. I still wind up doing them a lot of the time, but I try to avoid them. And I hope you appreciate that I do make the effort, even if I don't always succeed. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. I did get my cassette deck back from the shop, and it should be working now. So I am going to transcribe a tape of a Dr. Peter Beckman, Czech expatriate physics professor, talking about nuclear power. I don't pretend that this is going to be great, but I may upload that as a couple of filler shows for some time during this coming period. Utsuho says, self-packing and unpacking trucks are needed. Ain't that the truth? The bigger problem actually is sorting out which of this stuff I'm taking to my sibling and which is not going there. Which of it belongs to someone else and doesn't need to be transported all the way to Iowa. It's funny, I just saw on SDF Mastodon a job posting for a job I could probably bluff my way into in the town where my sibling lives. My sibling, who is very clear about not wanting to share a house with me ever again. But anyway, this is not going to be the best show that I've ever done, and part of that is because I've not been sleeping terribly well, and part of that is just because the school has started around here, and of course, what happens is that the dogs take this as an excuse to start barking as soon as the school buses start moving and the band practices start and so forth about 6 in the morning, and don't stop until about 10. In fact, what happened Friday, yesterday, is it only yesterday now? That shows you how unglued I am at the moment, was that I woke up about 5 a.m. and finally managed to get back to sleep and slept until after my showtime. So, you didn't get a new show from me yesterday, that's why. Yes. What else am I thinking about? Thinking about the fact that I shouldn't have left this teabag in this teacup. Tobe will chastise me for using teabags, and properly so, but my head is kind of wonky right now, which you can probably tell by the babbling I'm doing. Also, the cramp in my right shoulder that had me believing I had an ear infection is coming back, and so that's going to be wonderful to deal with. Anyway, and yeah, other than that, yeah, I missed listening to Synth Battle Royale last night because I was going to go to bed early, and then a friend phoned me up and wanted to chat, and so, not that I begrudge time spent chatting with my friends, but I didn't wind up getting to bed until much later than I had hoped. Anyway, so I'm a little punch drunk at the moment, which is not a good place to be heading into the Worldcon, particularly not with a big drive ahead of me. Anyhow, and I should report receiving two exceedingly generous donations, one from a friend in Nevada who prefers to be identified as Kuma Bear, which paid for the button machine, and one from SDF's very own Adam D., both of whom will be receiving some kind of token of acknowledgement from me. I will say that monetary contributions have, in my mind, two great functions. They do two things for me. One is to help me do some more stuff. So, for example, buy a button machine and make buttons. Order more stickers, which I have done. That's excellent. It also makes me feel as though what I'm doing isn't completely useless, that there are people who value it and want me to do more of it. And therefore, you know, that I'm not just pleasing myself with the things that I do, that I'm actually making a difference to someone somewhere, and that really does make me feel a lot better. And gives me more energy to do more things. So work continues on the briefing book. There's a lot of sitting down and consulting references, including my 56th edition 1975-76 CRC manual, which I was deep in last night because I was filling out a chart showing the various nuclei involved in the nuclear fuel cycle. So thorium-232 and uranium-238 and uranium-235 and 233, plutonium-239 and 241, and all the various other nuclei that you wind up with here and there. So I will let you know what the status is of the cyanotype paper moon badges that I've been making. So I did mention this before, I believe, that I've acquired a number of 1960s astrophotograph negatives, and I worked out that the size of the moon image on these negatives is about the right size to use with the button machine that I got. And this was not entirely fortuitous. This is the result of me comparing things and saying, wait, this will work. Anyway, the only hitch up so far, well, there's two hitch ups. The first is that it's overcast. I can't make cyanotypes when it's overcast. But yesterday was sunny. Yesterday was sunny, and so I was able to make some cyanotypes as a starting point. And I learned some very important things from this. The most important thing, unfortunately, is that the cyanotype paper is very, very thick. It's much thicker than the paper that the people who made these badge machine had in mind. And so that's posing a problem. So far, I have successfully crimped three cyanotype badges. One, I did it without the Mylar. And so it's the other two, I tried doing it with the Mylar, and the Mylar didn't crimp properly, but the paper crimped okay. And so what we have is a badge with paper with no Mylar over it. Which is not ideal. Now, there's a couple of things I can try to do. One is to get thinner cyanotype paper. I know it exists. I've got a packet of Sunprint paper, the stuff that you probably may have had as a kid or whatever. Unfortunately, it's 15 or 20 years old, I think, and exposure to atmospheric moisture, I guess, has denatured it to the point that it only barely takes an image. When it gets a little sunnier again, I'm going to try it again, but I have deep doubts that it's going to do anything useful for me. Okay, so the other remedy for this, so what I've been doing, because of course when you develop cyanotypes, you do it by rinsing them in water, and so the paper is very wet and limp until it dries. Okay, so in order to avoid having to deal with that, and centering and so on, what I've been doing is using the handy circle cutter that they gave me to cut out circles of paper, and then put the negatives over those, and then expose them. And the result is actually quite good. But what I'm going to have to do, I think, is to reduce the size of the circles, just fractionally, maybe as much as a millimeter, right? Reduce the size of the circles just barely. And then if I put them on there with the Mylar, it should work. We'll see if it actually works the way that I think. But in order to do that, first I've got to use the circle cutter to cut out the blanks for the non-cyanotype badges I've been making. So I went down to the office supply store and I had them run off 5 sheets of 6 examples apiece. I could get more onto a sheet, but it would get difficult to trim them, of the 2 designs of badge, one with the Radiant Fist and the motto, Atomic Power to the People, one with the smiling atom, and the motto, No Blood for Oil, Atoms for Peace. I went to the office supply store and had them do it because my home printer is an inkjet, and the instructions for the button machine say that the moisture in inkjet prints can cause the back shell of the badge to rust, which is obviously something you don't want. Now, of course, this also poses a certain constraint on the grounds of needing to let the cyanotypes dry very thoroughly before crimping them. But if necessary, I can take my badge machine with me to the convention and do the crimping there. But the thing is, because currently the only tool that I have for cutting out the badges, the button blanks, whatever you want to call them, is this circle cutter. Because, of course, when I called to order the badge machine, the circle punch, which cuts them with mathematical exactitude, was backordered. And so I should be getting that after I get back from the Worldcon, at which point, of course, I'll be able to cut out of sheets of paper to my heart's content. Anyway, so that'll be fine for the printed badges. Again, for the other reason I had them laser printed, honestly, is that the color on the laser print just pops better than the inkjet color. That's all there is to it, folks. Anyway, but if I'm using this handy circle cutter, of which I'm getting about 40% yield, then I'm going to want to finish all of those before I reduce the size down and then start cutting new Cyanotype badge blanks. See, comments in calm. Radiant Fist sounds like a revolutionary insurgency or a New Age pseudo-Hinduism cult. Or a martial arts style. Or a Japanese space shooter game. All of these answers are correct! All of these answers are correct. The Church of the Subgenius believes every part of every religion. But yeah, also, I discovered that the other negatives that I have some of trains, which I was able to identify as the Durango and Silverton, because the locomotive tender says Denver and Rio Grande Western on it. And if you know preserved steam railways, you'll be able to figure that out for yourself. But the other one, as it turns out, there's one of a dam. It turns out to be Hoover Dam. But I think Tobe was saying that he wanted some prints off of those train negatives. And I can do that. I can do that for anybody who really wants them. As I say, though, it's not going to happen unless the sun comes out. It's overcast. Anyway, so I know I've been talking the last few weeks about preventable catastrophes, right? Bad stuff that's happening, not because nobody could see it coming, but because people saw it coming and decided they had other priorities, like the water shortage in the East Cape region of South Africa. You know, they had 10, 12 years warning of the monsoon rains getting less and less every year, and they didn't even repair the pipes, much less add evaporators to their existing coal-fired power stations to get up some more water out of the ocean, which is right there. Preventable catastrophes. I mean, people talk about climate change, and it's true. It's been well over 100 years since Svante Arrhenius came to the conclusion that putting carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere could affect the climate. And of course, I've quoted to you before the fellow in 1958 saying that scientists tell me that putting carbon dioxide into the Earth's atmosphere could affect the climate, but that's not going to really matter because as the advantages of nuclear power are so great that it will rapidly eliminate the use of coal, and then we won't have to worry about that anymore because the supplies of oil and gas by themselves are much too limited. Oh well. But, you know, just in the field of energy supply, I mean, the gas crisis, the energy crisis in Europe right now, the fuel crisis, really, what it is. Again, this is something everyone could have seen coming. Right, I mean, simply put, when you give somebody control over your energy supply, you are giving him a weapon to use against you. And that weapon has been used over and over again. The United States used it against Japan in the late 1930s, right? United States, then the biggest exporter of oil in the world. Japan, an overwhelming maritime economy needing fuel for its ships, an industrializing economy needing fuel oil for its factories and power plants. And the United States said, we don't like what you're doing in China, and cut off their supply of oil. Which the Japanese looked at it and decided they weren't going to survive without oil, so they might as well start a shooting war. I'm not advocating for starting wars, but it's clear that people do it over oil. So when the Europeans decided that they were just going to hand control over their energy supplies over to Russia, you know, it's a foregone conclusion that the Russians would use this as a weapon. You know, no one could have been in any doubt as to this. They just decided it didn't matter enough for them. As opposed to, for example, when the European countries were installing nuclear power, right, because they saw the Suez Crisis, then the 1973 Arab oil embargo and all that, they decided they didn't want oil used against them as a weapon. And so they started building nuclear power plants. But the nuclear power plants they built needed enriched uranium, and that only came from the U.S. or possibly the USSR. So the French built a complete gaseous diffusion plant at Tricastin, and the British, Dutch, and Germans collaborated on developing the centrifuge enrichment technology so they wouldn't be tied to somebody who could potentially say, no more fuel for you. So, again, it's a foregone conclusion that Russia would use the energy supply as a weapon. I mean, again, insulating yourself from U.S. control of the nuclear fuel supply when, again, there were alternatives. There were, of course, reactor types that would use unenriched uranium, and there was the possibility of recycling plutonium, which would give you a lot of breathing room. Right. In Europe, though, it's not like they have enormous reservoirs of gas. And so, you know, the nuclear power plant can continue running for a long time without a new charge of fuel. A gas-fired power plant, if you turn off the valve, it turns off. Anyway, so again, predictable catastrophes. And now we have a situation in the American West. Hoover Dam. Lake Mead. I mentioned Hoover Dam before. I got a photo of it. Lake Mead is now at the lowest level it's ever been at. In other words, it has dropped below a level which it reached when the reservoir was originally filling. The Bureau of Reclamation has told the states that Colorado runs through that they've got to reduce their use of water. It has told them how much water they need to reduce. Are they doing it? No! They're saying it's unfair that they should have to do this. The government of Arizona, for example, is saying it's unfair that we should have to be reducing our water use. Buddy, I don't know how to tell this to you, but their water isn't there. Arizona says, well, you know, reducing the amount of water available will negatively impact, you know, our farmers. Yeah, your farmers in the middle of the desert, thank you very much. It'll negatively affect our growing cities. Our city, the growth rate of our cities will be curtailed. Well, maybe. People just shouldn't be moving to places where there isn't any water to drink. Did you ever think of that? But they say, well, it's unfair to ask us to reduce our water usage. It's unfair. Well, the lack of water is a physical fact. Physical facts don't care about what you think is fair. See, it isn't humans who are saying, oh, well, you need to reduce your use of water. This is not like the situation which has happened in Sri Lanka, where the government said, well, we're not going to allow fertilizer anymore. And the agricultural productivity imploded, and the country is in turmoil, and people are starving. You know, that was predictable, but it was completely caused by human agency. You know, I was listening to the radio. They had a story about somebody in Sri Lanka, and they were talking about how, you know, they can't get cooking gas anymore. There's no cooking gas to be had. And so his wife tried to cook on an open fire in the backyard, and she was hospitalized with smoke inhalation. I ever mentioned that, you know, fossil fuels aren't great, but in many cases they're better than the nearest alternative? Yes, this is one of those cases. So yeah, his wife got hospitalized with smoke inhalation. Then his grandmother, no, his mother, right, who could remember seeing her mother or maybe grandmother doing this when she was a little girl, took over the cooking because she at least had some vague idea of how to do it without getting sent to the hospital. But her comment was she'd never thought she'd see the country slide back so far. Anyway, but here's my point of view, I guess, that, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say that California needs to reduce its water usage. California has an entire ocean right there. If California generated all of its electricity from nuclear power stations up and down the coast, California could suck a lot of water out of the ocean, and the ocean would never even miss it. Because you know where it all winds up back again in the ocean. But Arizona doesn't have a seacoast. I know people may have tried to sell you a beachfront property in Arizona. Don't buy it. Arizona doesn't have that water source. Arizona is dependent on water which comes through the Colorado. Now, unless we have so much seawater desalting in California that they produce a surplus of water and turn it back into the Colorado River through the aqueduct, right, which is unlikely, Arizona is always going to be limited by the amount of water that comes down the river, which is in turn limited by the amount of snow that falls in the Rockies in the winter. There are going to be dry years. And of course, predictions involving climate change says those dry years are going to come closer together and they're going to be more severe. Anyway, you know, and even the Great Salt Lake is having problems. The only thing I can say is, again, there are people who have the power to affect that. You may not know this, but a large amount of the farmland in the area around the Great Salt Lake is directly controlled by the Mormon Church, which has a lot of business subsidiaries and things. So Family Canning brand peanut butter and pickles, that kind of thing. Anyway, so the first presidency of the Mormon Church could, in principle, decide to reduce the amount of irrigated land around the Great Salt Lake and let more water go into the lake. Interesting statistic that I saw in the Wall Street Journal, by the way, is that there will be less land area, fewer hectares of cotton harvested this year in the United States than any year since 1868. That's right, folks. 1868. Now, it peaked at about six times the current level in the late 1920s, early 1930s. But it's worth pointing out that productivity per hectare is much greater now than it was in 1868, probably about five times. But still, I'm confused about this because I was in southern Kansas a couple of years ago, and I saw that they were farming cotton there in what I'd been accustomed to think of as wheat country. So it seemed to me as though more acres, more hectares were being put under cotton than in the past. But I guess I was wrong, and so I'd like to know, what are the former cotton fields in my area growing instead of cotton, that the cotton has moved up to Kansas? But yes, I've been talking about preventable catastrophes, while simultaneously making one of my own by not being nearly prepared enough for the Worldcon, but that's, at least with me, you come to expect that. That if I were in charge of your government, I would have people to help me do these things, and I would probably be more efficient about doing them. Well, fingers crossed. Anyway, but I wanted to talk about something entirely difficult today, and I've still got a minute to do it in. Fun thought here. In the great age of sail, there were people who had traveled the distance to the moon and back. I'm fairly confident of that. And the simple reason is that the circumference of the Earth is about 40,000 kilometers. The distance to the moon is about 400,000 kilometers. And a sailor in the age of the clipper ships might circumnavigate the Earth every year, or possibly twice a year, although that was much less common. But a sailor in the age of the clipper ships might well circumnavigate the world every year and be in the business 10 or 20 years. And so by the time, that men first met to the moon, there were people, many, many people who'd traveled that far in their lifetime. What about the distance to Mars? Well, I worked it out. Airline pilot, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, typically flies about 75 hours a week. And multiply that by 1.5 to account for hours spent deadheading. 75 hours a month. Anyway, that's obviously wrong. 75 hours a month. Multiply by 1.5, multiply by 12 months a year, you get 675,000 kilometers, assuming he flies at 500 kilometers an hour. That's well more than the distance to the moon, obviously. Multiply that by a 30-year career, and you get about 90 million kilometers. The closest distance between the Earth and Mars, according to my TRW space data book, is more like 130 million kilometers.
7.